Group meeting, Friday, 28th October, 1983.
In our last few meetings, I have tried to present the outlook of total relationship with the whole of life. Now, I've tried to do that because that implies freedom from both acceptance and rejection of anything and everything in life. Now, this has a tremendous implication. We, as we are, spend our whole life, whoever we are, in accepting certain things, in rejecting other things. Isn't that true? We accept what we call good, what we call agreeable, what we call pleasant, and we reject their opposites. And our acceptance and rejection are determined by what we ourselves are at the moment, with all our conditioning, our heritage, and so on. But by this process of acceptance and rejection, we are denying some part or other of the cosmos, and overemphasizing another part of the cosmos, that which we like. Now you see, this means, therefore, that we are in a state of disharmony with the absolute, with the total manifested reality also. That's what that implies. Now, this is the result of our conditioning, mainly. And also our conditioning through our natural evolution as physical human beings, and also through our cultural, social heritage. And by cultural heritage, I also mean the aspect of religion, art, science, philosophy, everything. You see? So everything conduces to make us live as if we were separate from the totality, whatever that totality may be. And our ordinary conditioning from infancy onwards incapacitates us from accepting anything and everything. If we accept anything and everything, we are bound to be in complete relationship with the totality. But this sort of acceptance is an acceptance which only God, I'll use the simple word God, has. Nobody else has that. You see, there is a tremendous consequence of this sort of outlook. We do away with the distinction between good and evil. But don't be afraid. We may do away with the distinction between good and evil in our innermost consciousness because it is at one with the divine consciousness, which does not reject anything itself at all. we can transcend the conflict of good and evil in ourselves by means of such acceptance. And such acceptance is transcendent love and transcendent wisdom. That is the kind of thing towards which the human race is trying to develop. Well, I don't know whether it is trying, towards which human race could move. If that could be done, I would say that the purpose of human existence is completely fulfilled. That is to say, the purpose is fulfilled not in the sense that you or I or tens or hundreds or millions of human beings will have realized perfect humanity. They will have, of course, incidentally, that is the incidental part of it. It is transcendence which will have realized its own transcendence through each one of us as human beings. Transcendence will have realized full humanity. Then only are we literally sons of God, the Brahmaputras, or whatever we like to call it. But have we the strength, the capacity, the intelligence, the vision, the will? Will, not in the sense of imposing one's strength upon humanity or the world, but will in the sense of that pure aspiration in which all selfness is completely absent. Now, let us look at certain elements in our daily life. All over the world this applies. Science, religion, and the newspapers, they all have one out of maybe more unhappy effect. They deprive us of freedom of mind. People say, oh, but it is scientifically proved that this is so. Now, the history of science itself, if we look at it carefully, would make us reject that outlook. What has happened with science? It started with certain speculations by armchair philosophers. They happened to be right in one or two particulars, but it was only speculative philosophy. Very simple important example of that, a really important example, is the speculation which gave rise to the atomic theory. In China, in India, just probably a few decades before Democritus and Leucippus in Greece propounded the atomic theory. Now, what was the important point about it? The atoms, they declared, were created by God. The atoms are indivisible, invisible, indestructible. And once created, they live forever and ever until God withdraws all the manifested universe into himself. That was the general sort of presentation which we find in the Far East and in India and later on in Greece. But what was the consequence? Where theology, the philosophy of religion was concerned, God, who was only a spirit up till then, and had many, many spirits which did everything, thunder, lightning, rocks, rivers, and so on and so on, everything had its spirit, some mysterious invisible spirit which controlled the river or the thunderstorm, etc., etc. All that went out, and God as the supreme spirit controlling it all. That went out, and this aspect of God came into being. God is the invisible, the indivisible, the indestructible. So the idea of the eternity of God came into being as such. God is eternal. And just as God creates the atoms out of which all things in the universe come into being, He also creates immortal, invisible, eternal souls, indestructible souls. A soul inhabits us. So naturally they began to think, well, what happens to this soul afterwards? And they said, oh, this man's an evil man, he goes down to hell. And this man's a good man, and he goes upstairs to heaven. But they found all kinds of strange problems cropping up thereby. How can a God, who was only, after all, in man's conception, man himself, his good qualities, apotheosized, carried to the nth degree? And in those centuries, and in fact almost up till our modern 20th century, man did not realize that what he calls good comes into being simultaneously with what he calls bad. That the opposites come together simultaneously. This is one of the very difficult and rather terrible aspects involved in this sort of thinking in the old days. If you take all the religions of the world, you can start with Zarathustrianism, Judaism. Well, I don't know about Judaism. Yes, so they do have hell in some respects. Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, they all have a heaven and a hell. And my word, their imagination worked marvelously in picturing all the terrible things of hell. Dante's Inferno wouldn't get the first prize for presenting what hell was like. It really wouldn't. If you read the Buddhist descriptions and some of the Hindu descriptions, good God, you must have a strong heart to remain alive after reading that sort of stuff. You see? However, there it is. So all those things came about. Then the problem came, how on earth can a God who is all perfect, all good, etc., etc., be responsible for bringing about a state of affairs where it was possible for human souls to be evil? It was an unanswerable question. The real answer is simple and psychological, based upon the actual fact that you can't produce any one thing in manifestation without its opposite. Give you a simple example. Supposing I draw a line like this. Now, this surface, as you are looking at it, is concave. And as you are looking at it, the other side of this line is convex. It's the opposite. you see. And if you examine the situation very carefully, you will find that this applies in every single thing in our life. The two go together, always. What we have called good always goes with some corresponding evil as such. Because our good is a definition which is made by splitting up the totality. But the way you split it makes the one view represent good and the other view represent evil. It is the splitting up of this totality. The splitting up affects us, our inner consciousness. It goes deep down into our inner consciousness. And so there is this permanent state of conflict. Also, the old ideas raise up all kinds of other problems. They appeal to the ambition of man. I want to go to heaven. I don't want to go to hell. It will be rather interesting to meet the fellow who says, well, I don't mind having a look, you know. And so he strives to be good in this limited sense of the word good in order to go to heaven. So he's in a perpetual state of conflict, both within himself, because when he sees a wonderful damsel, he wants to so and so. When he sees a lovely Rolls Royce, he wants to possess it for himself, although he hasn't got the money and he wants to discover how he shall grab it for himself, and so on and so on. Raises up the whole state of conflict. This ambition in all departments comes out of that splitting up of the totality in our inner consciousness. We are not conscious of totality as totality. It is only a word for us yet. This is our difficulty. It is only a word. We may, because we are cultured people, we have been brought up nicely, we have a certain amount of natural urge towards that which is good and beautiful and true and all the rest of it. Because of that, although we have all that, we are ambitious for our own sakes. Because it will be pleasant for us, because it will be in accord with what I like, and so forth. So these are the things we have to be aware of. Being like this, it is not possible to be compassionate in the true and supreme sense. If one in his inner consciousness is really conscious of totality as totality, he will neither accept anything in the sense that he takes it for himself, nor will he reject anything. That's what happens. This is what happens. This is what happens. These things, in the limited sense of comparison with each other as regards values, this thing is evil, this thing is good, and so forth. That is true. That is true. This thing promotes life, that thing destroys life. That is all quite true. And at the same time, what we are unable to see is that what we commonly call destruction is an inevitable necessity for the emergence into the emergence into greater perfection. How do you grow? You die to the old state at any moment of your life, at any and every moment of your life. You die to the old state as you are emerging into the next state at the next moment. But you die to the old. The old has, in that sense, is destroyed. But that destruction is not an annihilation, do remember. That destruction is a transformation, It is a transmutation. If the transmutation doesn't take place, it is annihilation. That is true. You see, we have been so conditioned through the ages, not merely the thousands of years, but the millions of years. Man, as he is today, sort of started off, actually the hominid group and the pungid group. Those were the two parallel groups which started off something like 25 million years ago. That is, assuming our scientists are correct. You see? We started off then, and gradually there were changes and changes and changes, until finally just about 2 or 3 million years ago, creatures like ourselves actually began to emerge, and finally there was and is us as we are. So it's a very, very long time. But you see, this conditioning which has taken place through this immense period has robbed us considerably of our freedom of mind. So now this is from science and religion. Science and religion both have done this. Organized religion. True religion is this. It is whatsoever that purifies the person, the psychophysical organism, which promotes the evolution of man towards his culmination, and which enables the individual to realize transcendence. That is religion. Whatsoever does that is religion. In the grand sense, in the supreme sense, I think you'll find that statement quite inclusive. It excludes nothing whatsoever. And now, the newspapers. You know what people are like. You take the millions in the world. Oh, but I saw it in the papers. That is the fact. I've read it in the papers. This is truth. And we discover later on, when the, 30 or 50 year period of not giving out the actual, the records of the political process or whatever it is. When that is given out, you will find that what the paper said was not the truth. So you see how we are conditioned in all these ways, and what that conditioning does to us. So, in the absence of this freedom of mind, well, not a total absence, but a considerable absence, we do not question things. We do not challenge anything. Not challenge in an antagonistic spirit, not at all. Challenge it in the spirit of inquiry, in the spirit of investigation, of exploring for ourselves, especially in the religious context, what is the truth, and so forth. The religious context is so important because it strongly influences our ethic. It is the most powerful ethical influence on us. And the what we call the moral imperative in us actually derives not only from the religious conception of a supreme being or the absolute or whatever it is, not only from that, but also from our sense of sociality. All the people of the world today live as distinct societies. They have their particular way of life, and so on. And therefore, it lays down our relationship with our environment and with all the members that compose that society. Now, religion has perhaps the most powerful influence in this. Because, you see, there is so much involved. Happiness, fulfillment, as we conceive of happiness and fulfillment here, and in a hereafter, a postulated hereafter. How did the idea of a hereafter first emerge, do you think? You see, in very, very ancient times, going back hundreds of thousands of years, probably, when there were small tribes and they were at war with each other, and the big strong man slew his enemy, and then a little later he had a dream in which he saw his enemy again. There he was, and he was surprised. He said to himself, but I have killed this fellow. What does this mean? Is he alive or is he dead? Fear arose, you see. And you know how it is, what it is like in a dream. You try to run or you try to do this, that and that, and you just can't. It's the most frustrating thing. I know from my own dreams in my young days. Fortunately, I don't have any dreams like that now. You see, you try to run to escape, and you just can't escape. Even now, when I say now, I mean during the last 20 years, I've sometimes dreamt of a lion being there, you see, a lion walking about. and of course, I felt fear. I felt fear, and then suddenly I thought, but a lion does not walk about in my particular environment, in London. I argued it out in the dream, and the lion walked away each time. So you see, and then of course the fear went out. But this is the result of being able to be conscious in the real sense, not merely aware vaguely, but to be intensely conscious that, this is the fact of the situation, then fear disappears. So you see, the man dreamt of his enemy, and he dreamt that he was unable to get the better of him at all. So when he woke up, he was terribly perplexed. Good heavens, what does it all mean? Am I safe? Have I really killed my enemy? Or does he exist in a sort of a spirit state where he is immune from any harm coming to him through my strength and power, and so forth. And ideas of another world, an after-death state came into being. And this beginning was refined and refined as the ages passed, and made into the rather charming pictures that we make of the other world and the other life and this, that and the other. You see? And of course, correspondingly, we made equally horrible pictures of the state for the bad man. The bad man is always my enemy because I'm a good fellow. It is impossible for me to think of myself as anything but a good fellow. What do I do when I am aware that I've done wrong? That I'm thinking evil thoughts or feeling evil feelings or doing things which I ought not to do. What do I do? Oh, well, that's on just temporary. I'm really a good chap. I can put that aside. I dissociate a part of myself from my whole self. And the result is that there is a persona which is the good chap and there is the shadow. And our psychologists tell us we have to come to terms with the shadow, which is the mistake. You cannot come to terms with the shadow. You have to take the shadow completely into yourself. Acknowledge that shadow and see that, yes, that is me. That is the me, just as much as the persona is the me. And when one really can do that, then the enmity between the two aspects of oneself disappears. And the suicidal process of getting rid of the shadow disappears. So you see, it comes back to being conscious in terms of totality, the total self. Then our ethic can be a true ethic. Because when there is no split between what we commonly call self and not self, when there is no such thing as a self and a not self, there is only the one reality, the one total self, eternal God, that's all. Transcendence itself is the only reality, the absolute truth. And when one is really awake to that, not merely as an idea, as a philosophical concept or some such thing, but in your inner consciousness, which determines the kind of thought and feeling, word and action which will come out of you in your daily life. This is the very important thing to remember. This is why beliefs, convictions, which we get, most of our convictions are due to what has been imposed upon us. All those things, beliefs, convictions, ideas, fancies, all that has no reality. But to be conscious that this is so, then your life is your unique expression through which transcendence realizes itself. You see, we all know what the state of the world is like. And some of us who are powerfully egoistic, vain, and so forth, we run about trying to put the world right. And you know, through the ages, millions of people have tried to do this with rather sad results on the whole. The great spiritual teachers, those who had grown into their full fruition, the perfected holy ones, they never tried to put the world right. They only lived such a life, an exemplary life, which showed those in their environment how a human being should live. That is what happened, actually. You see, how few are the great religions? Just about 7 or 8 at the most. The great religions that we actually do know, of course, are Zarathustrianism. I'm more or less taking them in chronological order. Judaism, Hinduism, Buddhism, Christianity, when there is Sikhism. Jainism is only an offshoot of the kind of religious thought which prevailed in the same time as Gautama the Buddha flourished. Mahavira, the founder of Jainism, was an elder. He was about 20 years older than Gautama the Buddha. And his followers are a very small number, just about 2 million change in the world. But that's very much more than the Zarathustrians. We Zarathustrians, I mean, I as a Parsi, I'm a Parsi by race, and therefore my parents were Zarathustrians, and I was brought up as a Zarathustrian. But if I were to sign my name on the dotted line, whether I'm a Zarathustrian, I should, to be perfectly honest, sign my name on the dotted line under every great religion. Because religion means to me whatsoever purifies it. And it means getting free of ideas, beliefs, convictions, and all the rest of the imposed stuff. I have often wondered why the great teachers were concerned primarily with ethics. How many of the great spiritual teachers ever sit down to produce a book on philosophy? The perfected holy ones don't try to do that. You know why? Because long before you become a perfected holy one, you see quite clearly that any one philosophic system gives place to another later on. Because every philosophic system is based upon certain basic concepts which emerge out of the imperfect man. All the philosophers as philosophers, good as many of them were, not all, some lived horrible lives, but they just had that kind of brain which could take hold of two or three basic ideas and on that build a philosophy. Then, some years later, the next man comes along who has got his PhD studying this fellow's philosophy, you see, and finds a flaw here, logical flaw here and there, and then he raises up another system of philosophy to counteract it. The whole history of philosophy is like that. I have spent my lifetime since I was 10 and 12 years of age. When I was 10, I had read Plato. That kind of thing, you see, and thoroughly reveled in it. And then I knew what intellectual distress meant when, as I grew older and looked more and more deeply into it, I found out how all this is just the ghost of the truth. Just a shadowy picture. Not even an artist's really fine portrait. Even the best artist's portrait is only a portrait, not the living person. Isn't that so? The portrait is the portrait. So you see, all these things are of no special value. But where all the great spiritual teachers have been in agreement is in their basic ethical teaching. And that basic ethical teaching has just a few simple foundation stones, if you like. Love, truth, wisdom, purity, goodness. Just a few simple things like that. You see? And all the great teachers have taught just that as the fundamental. They have subscribed to the idea of God, archangels, angels, and so forth, because it was impossible for them not to do so. Nobody would have listened to them if you took away all the pet beliefs of the people. They would only say, well, what on earth is this man talking about? He's not in his right mind. Because you see, the millions cannot recognize the unique person who is in his right mind. How often I have heard very nice, intelligent people talking like this. If I had been alive in the time of Jesus, I would have never realizing what a fool he was saying that. If he had been alive in the time of Jesus, he would have been the same sort of conditioned Jew who dealt with Jesus as the Jews dealt with him. Don't you see? To be conscious in this truly human way implies that there has to be universal love in the absolute sense. There has to be wisdom. You can't have universal love, transcendent love, without transcendent wisdom. Just as you can't have a baby minus a father and a mother. Even if the father the living father is rejected and all these modern methods of insemination or something, even if you had it that way, there had to be a man involved in the procedure. So you see, it's like that. Love and wisdom, father and mother, to be there. So, ethic is the foundation stone of it all. And this sort of ethic of the great religions, and remember, when we are talking of ethic of the great religions, we are talking of a mere 6,000 years out of the 3 or 4 millions of human history. A mere 6,000 years. So you see, religion really is a force working towards a society, a transcendent socialism, if you like, in operation. And if you consider what we have been talking of tonight, in relation to socialism as understood in the world and as practiced in the world, you will see that it has no relationship to socialism in its actuality. What we have called the brotherhood of man is a socialist thing, isn't it? It implies the consciousness, not merely the belief, not merely joining a party or signing on the dotted line. It means the complete consciousness of us, not of you and I. No separation. Us, the totality, all humanity. Then you can have this.